This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Listening to Off Script. It is Dubai Eye 103.8, and it is the Three Amigos. I haven't said it for a while, so I will say it. Sonal Rupani, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, very well indeed. Thank you very much. I feel like I'm coming out now into the sunlight once more. I've been battling a bit of a sore... Well, in fairness, I've been battling a sore throat for about 4 years, but I've been a bit under the weather the last few days. I feel that I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Only so that you can reach this weekend again and start shouting at your TV.
That's exactly it.
All over again. Well. You recharge it just enough. Yeah. To get going for the next weekend's
sporting
action.
It's like his phone. He sort of recharges it overnight, leaves the house with 8% battery, and it somehow lasts in the day.
I mean, he doesn't charge it overnight because he's something of a psychopath. Who does that? Who doesn't charge their phone overnight? I don't know a single person.
Yeah, I just don't like plugs on.
Yeah, but what about Zoe? Surely she's charging her phone overnight.
I'm sure, but I get angsty. I don't want the fridge, I'll make an allowance, but right. TVs, everything needs, you know me, plugs need to come out. I get antsy. I can't sleep genuinely. I get stressed. So that's why my phone every morning is at about 8%. Luckily today, it's been charged and it's now fully fledged at 7 minutes after
five. You know why? Because he comes in with 8% battery, then spends about half an hour every single day in this routine of scrambling for somebody with a charger.
It's
instead
so
of having a charger in the office.
I know.
I mean, this has been going on for the 5 years that I've known you.
I am terrible.
Every single day is sort of a new battle of find the charger.
It literally is.
It's such a chaotic
way to live.
It's a way
to make life interesting.
It's chaos.
I've got to give a big shout out to Fazlou. That bloke has saved me more than anyone else on this planet. He just sees me. There you are, Chris. There's the lead. Bring it back, please. And there's been many times, you know what?
And how many leads has he had to buy?
Yeah. I think he's had to buy about 7. And I know this, and Fazlou, if you're listening, I love you, man. Thank you so much for all of your help over the years. Robbie Greenfield, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. I've learned a long time ago never to give you any phone charges. Because I never see them again. So, you know, your ROI on giving Chris a phone charger is very poor. Oh, it's like a Dubai investment. It doesn't pay back.
Depends who you are.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice, which considers your own personal circumstances.
This is not a slight, by the way. This is not a slight on my financial advice.
Yeah. Rob is purely speaking from personal experience, in case you haven't picked that up.
Yeah. He's a lovely guy and a terrific golfer as well.
That's the earliest legal disclaimer has ever been played on Off Script. You do you guys out there with your investments. Just don't listen to Robbie Greenfield. Right, I want to get to the story that you were telling me about. Apparently, we all should have received an email from someone rather important. Is that right?
No. Not an email. It's just something that has been rumbling in the UAE. A lot of people are talking about this. Of course, India Prime Minister Narendra Modi seems to have sent a message to Indians here in the UAE via WhatsApp with sort of no kind of forewarning of this happening all of a sudden. At least I did, and I think a lot of other people did. You open up your WhatsApp and you've got this message, of course, this message claiming to be from the Prime Minister coming as an attachment. I am not opening that attachment.
No.
I'm like, this is some weird kind of scam that I hadn't heard of. It turns out, apparently, it wasn't a scam, that it was like a legitimate message. The thing is, non-Indians have been getting it too. Everybody's been talking about this message. Did you guys get it?
I am a bit annoyed because I did not get it. I feel left out.
I got one from Bloomfields, but no.
What's Bloomfields?
I have no idea. I haven't opened that. I'm too frightened to. But it's some kind of spam. That was today. Did not get anything from Narendra.
Raj got it, he said, and he showed it to me. Yeah. But I think a lot of people confused by it. And there has been a lot more WhatsApp spam coming through, hasn't there?
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried.
It used to be a bit of a safe space from advertising.
Yeah, you're right.
I find it deeply upsetting.
For sure.
An awful lot of literature warning me against, you know, dodgy emails, dodgy WhatsApps. Be careful. One of my good friends was hacked on Instagram yesterday. And of course, then the crypto. Oh, look at me. I've bought this car off the back of my crypto. You need to get involved too. Follow Mary at 12395. Whatever it is, it's ridiculous. There seems to be an awful lot more of that going about.
Yeah, it's incredible how that works as well. Somebody from our station got hacked in that way on Instagram, a fellow presenter, and he actually shared the story about how one of his friends fell for it and lost a bit of money. Because it seems so obvious, doesn't it? That kind of crypto scam. It's like, hey.
I thought crypto was meant to, you know, introduce a bit of solidity and reliability into one's personal finances, not open one up to being hacked.
Oh, Robert, second time again.
Dubai I 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Let me get this straight. Crypto, the appeal of crypto is that it's decentralized, that it is immune and therefore protected from all of these different kind of attacks. Am I completely wrong here?
Why would it be completely protected from attack? The whole idea is it's a scammer who's getting you to quote-unquote invest in crypto, but you're really investing in some platform that is sending the money directly to the scammer. There's no crypto even involved in this.
Mm. Yeah, that's it.
Right?
It's literally just...
You're not actually investing in the crypto.
No.
The point is somebody's sending you to a fake website,
correct,
taking your money. There's no crypto involved.
Indeed.
Because crypto's made a heck of a comeback, hasn't it?
Rob, don't do it.
It
has. It's...
Bitcoin is on the rise, but I can't remember the current price at the moment.
Again, that's Business Breakfast 6 till 10. Don't listen to a word that's coming out of Robbie Greenfield's mouth. If you are taking financial advice from that bloke, I tell you what, you're taking your life into your own hands as well.
Yeah, I mean, with my track record for investing, I might have a little nibble at Bitcoin round about now. It seems that it's peaked. Therefore,
Robbie's going to lump in.
And then next week it will have quartered in value.
It peaked at $73,000. Yeah. That's on the 13th of March. It's already on its way down again. Currently at $63,000.
And you know, there's been loads of annoying stories about, if you'd invested in Bitcoin in 2009, you'd have now got 400 billion quid. Well, yeah, when it was worth like a cent per Bitcoin before it existed. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
If you'd invested in it in the 17th century, you'd have enough money to fund your own space expedition.
You'd be minted.
There's all those stories about NVIDIA at the moment as well. Exactly the same thing. If you'd invested $100 in NVIDIA in whatever year, you'd have this many millions now. Does it ever make you think you just take $100 and put them in like all the most obscure random accounts?
We should all be investing in space mining, shouldn't we?
I mean, that's actually a pretty good idea, probably.
Yeah, but we don't really have the... I don't think we've got the clout, have we? We've got the capital. We need quite a lot of capital, don't you?
You need a lot.
Imagine, that would be a great prank, wouldn't it? To phone up a space mining company and see if you could make a sort of £100 investment in the future of space mining. I've got 500 dirhams. I want to spend it wisely. What do you recommend? What kind of industry should I move into here?
Let's get producer Rog on that this very second. That's his job, to set that up.
The Offscript Podcast.
From the team that brought you The Man That Could Not Be Interviewed with Steven Seagal.
Let's just get it over with.
This is Behind the Scenes, coming to a radio near you now.
Steven Seagal's appearance on that little sweeper is fitting for a feature that is full of hostility and acrimony. And I'm going to talk today about this. This is very much in the canon of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Cleopatra, films with just utterly weird, crazy backstories.
Love it.
This is where we're going today. It doesn't really matter if you haven't seen the film. There are some spoilers, by the way, if you haven't seen it. But I guess it was out in 1982. If you haven't seen it by now, it's probably not going to be high up on your list. Its name is Fitzcarraldo. And it is Werner Herzog's, and certainly in his weird alternative view of the world, I think it's his pièce de résistance. Huh. Okay? I mean, this is a guy that once got shot with an air rifle during an interview and didn't break stride. He just carried on his interview. He's known as one of the quirkiest, most eccentric filmmakers of all time. And I think Fitzcarraldo is almost his crowning achievement in craziness. It's just a bonkers film. It's got a bonkers backstory. It's set in a hostile environment deep in the Peruvian rainforest. And it's just got all the ingredients for fireworks off camera. Number one, it was filmed on location in a dense jungle.
It was actually filmed in the Peruvian jungle.
Yes, it was filmed on location. Number two, it was directed by Werner Herzog, a man who says stuff like this when asked to comment on said jungle setting.
There's a lot of misery, but it is the same misery that is all around us. The trees here are in misery and the birds are in misery. I don't think they sing, they just screech in pain.
Cheaper burner.
You need to send him those tips for happiness, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Now, it starred German actor Klaus Kinski, one of the most volatile actors of all time and Herzog's arch nemesis. Now, it's really weird these two hated one another because Herzog made Kinski's career. He basically gave Kinski his career and has described him as a monster and a great pestilence. Almost like an addict is drawn back to using whatever substance it is that they are addicted to. Herzog kept getting drawn back into casting Kinski in his movies. He cast him in Aguirre, Nosferatu, Wojciech, Fitzcarraldo, and Cobra Verde. And in every one of these shoots, Kinski would just scream the house down. He'd refuse to be directed. He would make mortal enemies of the crew and the supporting cast. I'll give you a little flavour of Klaus Kinski. Here he is wrapping up some media duties.
And Klaus Kinski threw a wobbly at his own press conference.
Crétin! Crétin! Vraiment crétin! Moi, je fais une fatigue de venir ici, tu comprends? Jette-le dehors! Finis cette conférence de presse! Et la moto! Idiot!
I was going to ask if we needed the bleep button until I heard the bleep.
I have sort of school level French and I could only detect one swear word in all of that.
That's
so
a worry.
I bleeped that out.
School level
French. Any French listeners who are offended by that, I do apologise. So that you get the gist of him. He's quite a lot.
Yeah, he's eccentric.
He's quite a lot. So what is Fitzcarraldo about? Here's Werner Herzog explaining the nuts and bolts of the plot to David Letterman.
Well, the name is derived from the British or Irish name Fitzgerald. The leading character's name is Brian Sweeney Fitzgerald, but as people down in the Amazon can't pronounce his name properly, he calls himself Fitzcarraldo. It's a story based in the Amazonian jungle during the turn of the century, during the rubber boom, which was like a gold fever, and he wants to bring great opera into the jungle, and he's kind of a dreamer and settles out for an expedition to move a huge steamboat over a mountain into another river system, which is inaccessible because further down you would find the most violent rapids in all Latin America. And he just moves the boat over the mountain, and it ends quite happily at the end.
So
I'm pretty sure he just like wakes up from a crazy dream, which we all have, just scribbles all the notes down and then turns them into movies.
So this is a guy who wants to bring high opera to the Peruvian rainforest. That's the crux of this plot. And as one scribe put it, Fitzcarraldo is about an insane man trying to haul a boat over a mountain. The documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo is about an insane man trying to haul a boat over a mountain. And here's Klaus Kinski, a madman, expertly portraying a madman in the movie.
I want my opera house! I want my opera house!
So 20th Century Fox were considering funding this film. Ultimately, they chose not to. But they asked Herzog how he was planning on shooting the scene where a 320-ton riverboat is pulled over a hill between two rivers. Okay.
Right.
Now, unsurprisingly, the studio were like, look, I think we should use special effects. Let's build models. Let's get this thing done. Herzog was having none of it. He said, I will only shoot this film by actually pulling the boat over the hill. Okay. So if Fox didn't want to give that the go ahead, he just didn't want to take their money. So they said, no, you're totally mad. We're not in. So the film is produced by Werner Herzog Film Production and Wildlife Films Peru. Is the co-production company 20th Century Fox to Werner Herzog Film Production and Wildlife Films Peru, essentially, which is basically the only way they could get it funded. Now, initially, Kinski was not cast to play Fitzgerald Fitzcarraldo. This is where it gets really weird. The first actor cast was James Robards, and his assistant, who was also cast, was Mick Jagger.
Of Rolling Stones.
I would have loved to see this version.
Yeah. Now, this arrangement lasted quite a few weeks, but Robards hated working in the jungle, and he hated it even more when he contracted dysentery.
Oh.
And this led to an enforced break in the shooting. Herzog briefly considered playing the lead role himself, you know, if a job's worth doing and all that, before ultimately going, ugh, let's give it to Klaus Kinski. Let's bring this lunatic in. And if there is one man that you want alongside you in an unforgiving, punishing environment, it is not this man.
You can't go anywhere. You can't go. You can't escape off this stinking camp because you never know when they call you, because you have to be here, because you're paid for. you're under contract, so you can't just go.
Yeah, that's your job, Klaus. You've been paid to do that. You knew what you were signing up for.
Why am I hearing Scottish twang?
You can't go. Now, he became such a problem that a group of indigenous people working for Herzog as extras on the set offered to kill him. They were like, listen,
we'll do you a favour.
we'll take him out for you. We'll make it look like an accident. Herzog actually declined, but, you know, the bad blood was running both ways. And Kinski was later asked, this is again on the David Letterman show, about whether it was true that he pulled a gun on the director during shooting.
He says that you pulled a gun on him.
We arrived at night with Howard, having eaten anything for 24 hours. Everybody fell in the mud and really sing. And I just screamed out. I said, okay, if this is going to continue, I'm the first one who's going up.
Right.
Going away. And he said, if you go away, I kill you. I said, this is just what I'm waiting for. Just camp to my place, okay? And I had my own raft, and then he was coming in the morning, but just apologizing that I had was the only one who had a Winchester, a rifle in the jungle. He didn't have a gun.
Oh, so he threatened you. He said, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
But he didn't have the gun.
He didn't have
the gun. You had the gun. But you...
You know what he sounds like?
Jürgen Klopp.
No, Rob. And I ask everyone in the cars when it's safe to do so to check this out. He sounds like Robin Williams. You know the late, great Robin Williams?
Yes.
Doing the Scottish accent when he's, you know, the golf skit,
hole. Yeah, yeah.
He sounds like him.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Yeah, a bit.
I need a little bit of translation. I was really paying attention to that.
Yeah.
But I struggled.
Basically, what he was saying was they were going to have this big meeting and he was the only one who had a gun.
Yeah.
So he felt a bit secure there. But it turns out that Herzog on that occasion came to apologise, so they didn't need to resort to firearms.
Right.
But, you know, push come to shove, no one was getting killed. But listen, Kinski was toying with the idea of at least a violent act.
I would have done something maybe without warning him.
Okay? Yeah.
No, I don't have to threaten him.
Yeah.
Not to kill him, but I mean just, I don't know, whatever.
I don't know, whatever.
But, you know, they were both provoking one another. After one altercation, Herzog went to his personal tent and he took a piece of chocolate that he'd saved for months, which, according to Herzog, you know, this is something that however many months they'd been in the jungle, the crew would have absolutely killed for this. And he returned to Kinski and he sat very close to Kinski and he just ate the chocolate in front of him. And apparently Kinski just went silent, just got into a strop. But, you know, you've got, you know, this maniac, possibly a murderous one, playing the lead role. Consider now that the film took about 5 years to make.
What?
As Herzog explains here, a lot of that time was taken up with pre-filming precautions.
Most of it, is pre-production. We had to build two identical huge steamboats that were not there around. So we had to be afraid we would lose one of the boats in a rapid scene. The boat actually went four times through the most violent rapids in all Latin America. So we thought if it sank, we would need another 2 years to build a new boat, and you don't get your crew and the actors back on location after such a time. We actually didn't lose it, but we almost.
They built two boats just in case one of them crashed during the scene of the filming of it.
Why didn't he just get an existing boat instead of building a boat for this? This is crazy.
They had to build two boats from they built two 321 320-ton steamboats from scratch. And that was before filming started. And you know, when you spend this amount of time in a place like this, you know, chances are you're going to run into some bad stuff.
Yeah.
We hear loads of stories about the lawlessness of these kind of places. And sure enough, shooting was further disrupted, not by rows between the cast members, but by a full-scale international conflict.
We were caught in the border war that was building up Peru and Ecuador. There was also some feuding native factions that, and we got caught in the middle of that, and they attacked our camp at the end and burnt it down. We had two plane crashes. We had all kinds of things that can happen. And, of course, we moved this boat over the mountain, and it has not been done before.
No.
I mean, nobody, there was no necessity for such a thing. So there's literally no precedent in technical history for such a thing.
I need to watch this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking at the trailer, it's crazy.
Unless,
it's, They genuinely drag the boat up the mountain.
And I'm looking at a photo of this boat. I mean, it is absolutely massive.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah.
It's inconceivable that they could drag it up a mountain.
And it's so stupid and unnecessary as well. It's just a kind of, it can be done, therefore we'll do it. Now, the film was shot during one of the region's driest summers ever, and the indigenous Amahuaca launched a hit-and-run raid on the film camp. Now, one man was hit with an arrow through his throat. He survived. His wife was hit in the stomach. That necessitated 8 hours of emergency surgery. Now, according to Herzog, he said he assisted by illuminating her abdominal cavity with a torchlight and with my other hand sprayed the repellent clouds of mosquitoes that swarmed around the blood.
Oh, my word.
Oh.
He decided against a revenge attack, did Herzog, believing it would be bad for relations. And plus, they just had a job to do. They had to, you know, carry on the filming. But I think a lot of the extras that they were using were chomping to go and get their revenge. And he basically had to talk them out of it. A couple more other crazy bits and pieces that happened. A Peruvian logger was bitten by a poisonous snake. He cut off his own foot with a chainsaw.
What?
To prevent the spread of the venom. And Herzog commented it was a good decision because he lived. Sorry, it was a good decision. He lived.
No, Mr. Bond.
Yeah. his musings on the jungle can be found in the documentary about the making of the film. It's called Burden of Dreams.
Oh, what a
title. It looks really good. And this monologue is just Herzog at his poetic best.
The only thing that is lacking is the dinosaurs here. It's like a curse weighing on an entire landscape. And whoever goes too deep into this has his share of that curse. Taking a close look at what's around us, there is some sort of a harmony. It is the harmony of overwhelming and collective murder.
A man for the dramatic.
Yeah, it really is. Now, the cinematographer Thomas Mauch, his hand was split open trying to film the climax of the movie. He underwent a 2.5-hour operation to put his hand back together without anesthesia.
Oh, my word.
The filming a scene on the rapids, one actor had to be lashed to the helm for fear he would fly through the windows when the ship crashed against the rocks. Loads of other stuff went down. Roger Ebert, the film critic, gave the film 4 out of 4 stars. He added it to his great movie collection. He actually said he compared it to films like Apocalypse Now and 2001, A Space Odyssey, when he said that we are always aware both of the film and of the making of the film while watching it, concluding that the movie is imperfect but transcendent. Herzog, it seems like a lot of effort to have not won that many awards, but he won the award for Best Director at the 1982 Cannes Film Festival, and it was selected as the West German entry for the Best Foreign Language Film at the 55th Academy Awards, did not make the final shortlist. And here he is, here's Herzog, years later, summarising his thoughts towards Fitzcarraldo.
Although it's a wonderful film, it gave me a lot of trouble. We had 2 plane crashes. We ran into a border war between Peru and Ecuador, a camp for 1,100 people that I had built in the jungle was attacked and burned to the ground. My leading actor, Jason Robards, became ill after halfway shooting, and I had to start all over again. So, and at one point in exasperation, I said I should rather book myself a room in a lunatic asylum after I'm done.
I need to watch this film. I've just Googled it there. It's intrigued me. It is genuinely a 320-ton boat.
Yeah, which they drag over a hill.
Mental.
For absolutely no reason whatsoever. They could have saved themselves a lot of time if they'd done what 20th Century Fox had recommended and just used a model.
I need to get on this. I really do. Right, that was brilliant, Rob. Thank you very much. What inspired you for that choice today?
I was just looking at films with crazy backstories and I stumbled across it.
The Off Script Podcast.
It's back. Come on then, Stones.
Well, we're going to band name origins.
Part 2.
That's mostly because when I first put this together,
she didn't finish it.
I had some ideas left over and I thought, let's flesh them out.
You know when you like you have a pizza and you don't finish the final 2 slices and you just open the fridge door the following morning and whack it in the microwave? That's the radio equivalent of what we're doing here.
Except those 2 slices take all of 10 seconds.
Except these are absolute doozies because I've already seen the first one.
All right, let's get to this band to start.
In a white room with black curtains, here's a station. Black roof country, no
The band is Cream, as we well know, because we do play that song quite a bit on Offscript,
don't
we?
Love that song.
Eric Clapton, Jack Bruce, Ginger Baker, they all get together to form basically what is the first supergroup, essentially. Because they all, in their own right, had very impressive reputations in the music scene over in the UK, between work with the Yardbirds, the Graham Bond Organization. The thing is, they knew it. They knew that they had those reputations. They knew their skills, and they weren't modest about it. So their name, Cream, references that directly. The cream of the crop of 60s British rockers.
Modest of them.
Yeah, exactly. The best of the best.
Is that genuinely? Oh.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you think, how does a supergroup like that even come together?
Cream. Oh.
There was me thinking they were marketing some kind of skincare product or something.
Could have been worse.
For a food fungus.
What you need is some cream on that.
Why did we go to Somerset for that, Rob?
I don't know, I'm just assuming someone called Ginger Baker is probably from those parts, but... He was on our Mount Rushmore of drummers, wasn't
he?
He was the drummer on our Mount Rushmore.
I think he did make it on there. So I suppose if you're making it on our Mount Rushmore all those years later, you really are the cream of the crop, aren't you? But when you think of a supergroup like this coming together, this is the story, according to Ginger Baker himself, with a little quip from Jack Bruce. Now, those two had worked together in the Graham Bond organization already. And Baker says he's fed up. He wants to start his own band. Eric Clapton comes to mind as he's thinking of somebody he could be in a band with. So he goes to see him at a gig. They performed together. It was electric.
I said to Eric, you know, like getting a band together. Would you like to join the band? And he said, yeah, straight away. Eric said, what about a bass player? And I said, He said, what about Jack? Ginger fired me from the Graham Bond band, but I refused to be fired, you know, because he wasn't even the band leader. Jack and I had several altercations during the Graham Bond days.
Several altercations is putting it lightly between those two and their relationship their whole lives, because Ginger Baker said, you know, when Eric Clapton said, what about Jack? I thought, not sure, but he's a bleeping good bass player.
Well done,
so they decided to go with that. The tension stayed with them for life. And in fact, the story, now, nobody knows if this story is true. It's kind of besides the point. It's reported often enough that people say it represents what their relationship was like. The story goes that when Jack Bruce was about to pass away, when he was a few hours from death in 2014, he phoned up all of his close friends to say goodbye. He called his ex-Cream bandmate, Ginger Baker, and he said, I'm dying, Ginger. Bleep you, and then slams down the phone.
Oof.
Just getting the last word in.
I love it. There's something quite, you know, there is actually something quite nice about that. There's something endearing about it as well.
There's
right?
something romantic of the notion of something that has that amount of tension that you both can't live with it and without it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I'm with you on that.
All right, let's move on to this band now. I'm only happy when it rains. Now, somehow, the story of their band name is a little bit more fitting. It's more in keeping, I think, with how rock bands tend to approach these things.
Well, if it's anything like Cream, it means that they just realized they were all rubbish, right? You're kidding me.
That's kind of where that comes from. It's a bit jokier than that. But yeah,
really?
In the same vein, it was kind of the direct antithesis to how Cream got their name. Basically, Butch Vig, who was the band's drummer and producer, he'd already had great success, by the way, as a producer and songwriter before he was in Garbage. He was best known for producing Nevermind, the Nirvana album, of course. So he was doing well. He did not need to set out and start a band, which was seen as a risky thing to do.
I also felt immense pressure. A lot of people started telling me, man, you made a big mistake doing a record with a band. You know, you just became a very successful producer, and this is, if the record flops, it could be the end of your career.
So Butch, after making Nevermind, not just Nevermind, he'd worked with the Smashing Pumpkins as well. I mean, he'd done incredible work. Another thing he was starting to get was like remix work. So House of Pain's Jump Around.
It was his.
Yeah, so he's doing that kind of, those kind of sampling types of records as well, as it's a relatively, you know, newer thing that people are working with, these kind of loops and samples. So he gets together with some friends and fellow musicians, Duke Erickson and Steve Marker, and they're kind of thinking about starting a band. And then the idea is, like, why not take that kind of sound, that sample loop sound, and turn it into a band? Mm. Kind of use that and reference it. And they didn't really have... you know, they didn't have their lead singer yet. They're just kind of playing around, trying to get this sound right. And they play it for a friend who simply says, sounds like garbage.
Love it.
And so that's how they came up with the name. It was a bit of a joke. At one point, Butch Vig also wrote in a journal, without coming up with anything cool, and when you least expect it, it all falls into place. I hope all this garbage will become something beautiful.
Decent. Like that. Nice. Right. Very good.
All right, we're going to talk about The Doors now. Now, they were formed in L.A. in 1965. I didn't realize they were formed quite so early. UCLA film students Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek. And it all started on L.A.'s Venice Beach. So back in 1965, Morrison is hanging out with Manzarek and says, listen, I've been writing some songs. And he goes ahead and sings Moonlight Drive to him. Manzarek was speechless. He had never really heard lyrics to a rock song quite like that before.
Heart beside the ocean on our moonlight drive.
Now, in terms of the name, you can settle in a little bit for this one, because, you know, you get the sense from the lyrics that Jim Morrison, he's a poetic kind of guy, sort of a bit of an intellectual, a thinker, philosophical, right? Now, he proposed the name The Doors because he was inspired after reading Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, which was a bit about, the book itself was about a hallucinogenic substance.
Right.
And Huxley got the title of the book from a quote by an English poet, William Blake, in an 18th century book called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And the quote is this: if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern.
Oh, beautiful, poetic. Love it.
So all of that is how The Doors basically got their name. It's all about the doors of perception. And the keyboardist and co-founder of the group as well, Ray Manzarek, was quoted in 1967 in Newsweek for describing the name, saying, there are things you know about and things you don't. The known and the unknown, and in between are the doors. That's us.
That's this is mumbo jumbo.
What was more coherent? Richard's story about playing with Ginger Baker, or
typed out by Rog?
That was,
put it this way, it's a much more alluring backstory than Nickelback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Fair. I love it.
Yeah, it's nice.
No, I dig it for sure. All right, this, now we're moving on to one of Rob's favorite bands. Now, if I had said Shine On You Crazy Diamond by T-Set, would that have worked for you?
Wow. No, because that probably was, that their name originally under Syd Barrett?
Well, it's complicated how they came together. It all started when Roger Walters and Nick Mason met. They're studying architecture. They start playing with a group of six. At this point, Syd Barrett's not in the group yet. And
we should point out this is Pink Floyd for anyone that
isn't. Oh, right. Sorry, Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Exactly. They start playing with a group of six. So initially, they're known as Sigma Six.
Oh my God, that sounds like a housing development project in International
GBC.
City.
Yeah. I live in Sigma Six.
Yeah, where are you? I'm Sigma Six. You take the second roundabout and first right.
I mean, it's like the program of a business coach, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
Join me in my Sigma Six program for your success.
Indeed. Wow.
They went through several names. I mean, they're students still at this point, right? So you know how this story goes. It's kind of one person moves, another person joins the band. The whole lineup is shifting, as are the names. So the multiple names they had before they reached even the T-Set was the Megadeths.
But Megadeth is an actual group, which came after them, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, Megadeth is.
The Megadeths.
Oh, the Megadeths.
That's wow, that's
How about
crazy.
This one? The Abdabs, before they were the Screaming Abdabs. I didn't bother looking up what
do.
They were Leonard's Lodgers, which actually I quite like. Leonard's Lodgers.
No, but they wouldn't have been the iconic band they came to be if they were called Leonard's Lodgers. I mean, I'm sorry, you can't release Dark Side of the Moon as Leonard's Lodgers.
No, you're right.
At one point, Spectrum 5.
That just sounds like the next James Bond movie.
Yep. And you know, by the time...
Starring Aaron.
Aaron Taylor-Johnson is James Bond in Spectrum 5.
It really works. It really fits. So by the time Syd Barrett's joining the group, they'd settled on the T-Set. I couldn't quite get to the bottom of why they got to T-Set or any of those other names previously, to
be
honest.
They were very kind of hippie and very sort of psychedelic back in the day when they first released the album that Syd Barrett actually worked on. It sounds nothing like what Pink Floyd became. They've gone through more changes, I think, than almost any other band in rock history.
Do you like the Syd Barrett albums?
No. I think they're awful. Right. I've listened to them. I think that I've listened to all. There's some Floyd albums that are just the weirdest things. There's an album called Umma Gumma, which is basically in Umma Gumma, there's a 23-minute instrumental with brass band and weird sound effects, and it's not even a song. It's like a
self-indulgence.
It's totally bizarre. I think a lot of that kind of stuff was happening in the late 60s and early 70s. Then they released Metal, which was the start of the kind of genesis of where Pink Floyd would get to, and then they released Dark Side of the Moon, and that was their masterpiece album.
Right.
And the rest of the albums they released in the 1970s were all brilliant. But they were very odd and a weird kind of outfit when they first came out. And that, because I think Syd Barrett already had quite severe mental issues when they first started to produce music.
Yeah, of course. He wasn't in the band for long before those mental issues really became an obstacle. And you know, he became a bit of a recluse, as we know, later on in his life. But one day in 1965, they're about to play a gig and they look at the bill and they realize they're one of two bands that night performing as T-Set. So on the spot,
popular name, was it? Yeah.
On the spot, Syd Barrett, who loved the blues, American blues, especially two players, one called Pinckney Anderson.
I don't hit my fault if I don't get well no more.
And sounds like the soundtrack to True Detective season one.
Yeah, it does.
Another blues artist called Floyd Council.
And I leave my baby crying.
So he's looking at this bill, he sees two sets, and he thinks that's not going to work. So he comes up with a new band name on the spot, the Pink Floyd Sound.
Whoa.
And of course, they eventually drop the first and last words of those names.
And Pink Floyd is a great name for a rock band.
Yeah.
The Screaming Abdabs. Screaming Abdabs. Or Aaron Taylor Johnson's new James Bond movie, Spectrum 5.
The Off-Script Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.